morning, everyone. It looks like we have everyone here, two attorneys and three judges. We have Judges Ross and Reyes, and I'm Judge Sleater presiding today. Welcome to the virtual Court of Appeals. We've had success to this date, so but let us know during this proceeding if at any time you cannot hear each other or see or have other technological issues. You'll see the clock. Jack Fink is marshaling for us today, so that is how you'll know your time. Everything else also will be relatively similar to what you're used to, 15 minutes apiece for argument and 5 minutes for appellant's counsel for rebuttal. And we do ask that you identify yourself for the record when it is your turn to speak. And so I'll just note for the record the file number that we're proceeding on today. It's the second of our three oral arguments, A19-1141, State of Minnesota versus Lillian Carletta Richardson, who is the appellant. And when counsel for appellant is ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I'm an assistant state public defender, and I represent the appellant, Lillian Richardson. This court must reverse Ms. Richardson's racketeering conviction because she was not associated with an enterprise, and must reverse all of her convictions, including the theft and racketeering convictions, because the state did not prove that she aided and abetted eight counts of theft by swindle of over $35,000. I'd like to try to address both of those issues this morning, if time permits. Now, the arrangement at issue in this case was not an enterprise, as the Minnesota Supreme Court and the Minnesota legislature have defined that term. The district court found that the arrangement here was, quote, a loosely affiliated set of agencies carrying out a scheme with a common purpose, end quote. That arrangement is not an enterprise. No Minnesota court has ever upheld a racketeering conviction on the basis of such an arrangement. And as the Supreme Court explained in the Wynn matter,
but just so we're clear, the district court did properly cite the three elements of an enterprise, one of which would be, I think the one you're challenging is the second element, which is having some sort of a structure or arrangement. You would agree that the district court did cite at some point the right law.
I would agree. I do agree with that, Your Honor. The order speaks for itself, and the district court cited how Wynn defines an enterprise.
So
but the district
case,
court,
don't we have some sort of arrangement necessarily? We as to how decisions are made. Doesn't the fact that we have a unique design in this scheme, particularly the distribution of funds to people, including your client, and more specifically, the fact that your client is unnamed in any of the documents, that she's sort of hidden by all of these participants, doesn't the fact of her not being named indicate a decision not to name her? And doesn't that decision necessarily imply an arrangement in decision making of some sort?
I'll answer the last part of your question first, Your Honor. No, it doesn't. I suppose you're right. There are conscious acts here that can be described as decisions. But what the Supreme Court has required, the conscious act being somebody decided not to include Ms. Richardson's name on the enrollment forms. Sure, that is true. But what the Supreme Court has required for an enterprise is a decision-making structure, meaning you have to have people telling other people what to do. You have to have a...
Right. And in this case, since multiple people produce these forms and her name was absent from all of the forms, doesn't that mean that someone decided not to include her name? And that decision was uniform among all the different entities and participants. And it would imply that there had to be some arrangement to come to that decision and to communicate that decision to all the participants who omitted her name.
I don't think, Your Honor, in the way that an enterprise, the decision is required for an enterprise. What you would need for an enterprise is someone to come in and say, you will leave Ms. Richardson's name off this form. You will do that. And in exchange for you doing that, we will do X, Y, and Z. Or if you don't do that, we will come and beat you up or set fire to your building or something.
A second. There's, you know, the consequential part that you just mentioned is not in the case law, is it? There doesn't have to be a, if you don't do it, bad things will happen. There just has to be a decision. As I understand it, there has to be some arrangement to make decisions.
There has to be a hierarchy, Your Honor. And so a hierarchy necessarily implies somebody giving an order and somebody, and there being some, I agree that what the specific consequences aren't in the statute, but what the example that the Supreme Court endorsed in Wynn is the witness who said, quote, you must have a hierarchy. You must have people telling people what to do. That implies some sort, and it doesn't have to be formal. I agree.
That was going to be my question, Mr. Butler. When they lay out the three factors and the second factor, they simply describe it as some sort. So would it be safe to say a sort? For instance, an organization could say, we will make no decisions unless it's unanimous consent. In theory, that means everybody would have to agree, and I might not get done, but eventually, so the point being, there's no hierarchy, it's a flat curve. Other situations might be people decide to kind of make decisions and ultimately they're successful or not, but they're still, and this seems to be part of the case here, one single end. But isn't that key phrase, some sort, so wide open, so broad, that it would be hard to argue a specific mafia style of hierarchy, which I think is what you're attempting to argue is the only type of organization that would fit?
You know, Your Honor, I don't think a mafia-style hierarchy is the only organization that would fit. I do think that's what the statutory drafters had in mind, but it's probably not true that that's not that that's the only hierarchy that can fit. But well, I do think you must have something. Because
when you say that's not the only hierarchy that can work, by choosing the language, some sort of arrangement, going to Judge Slater's question, a hierarchy is just one sort of arrangement. There are multiple sorts of arrangements. All we have to know, all the jury has to conclude, is that there is some sort. If we don't even have to know what it is, but something, some arrangement must have resulted in this decision making. Am I correct?
I don't think that it can be any sort of conscious decision, because I think that blurs the line between a racketeering structure and a conspiracy structure or an aiding and abetting structure. So what Wynn Court said is all criminal activity by multiple people, all of it is going to involve some sort of decision-making or some sort of agreement. And so the lines the legislature tried to draw were between different types of agreements and different types of decision-making. Now, if two people agree to commit a crime and do an overt act in furtherance of that crime, that's a conspiracy. That's not a racket. Yes, Your Honor.
For a moment there, you were blacking out. I didn't know if that was just me or if the others were hearing you fine.
I'm sorry. Sure. What I was saying was that there's got to be some distinction between a conspiracy, an aiding and abetting liability, and a racket. And the racket has to require something more than people get together, they agree to commit a crime together, and then they go out and commit that crime. And I think Judge Ross's questions, which are excellent questions, I think those examples go to a conspiracy much more than a racket. The word structure can't be so broad as to mean literally anything, or else you have no distinction.
But so Mr. Butler, to that point, I mean, the district court said it was a, quote, loosely affiliated set of agencies. That sounds to be something more than just a bunch of people getting together and just talking about committing a crime of some kind. The reference to agencies does indeed sound more formal than the examples that you're providing. Why isn't that enough, especially when case law has said and we've held that you only have to have a basic informal structure? If you've got a set of agencies, that seems to certainly meet the standard there for racketeering.
Because, Your Honor, the agencies are just the businesses. So the agencies stand in place, in this case, the agencies stand in place of the people.
Right, but if you have an agency, you have to have somebody or some people running that agency. There's already a certain amount of formality when you have an agency in place.
I think that's probably true, but it's not formality in terms of running a business. It's got to be a formality or a hierarchy in terms of the criminal scheme. And so what you need is somebody running the criminal part of the scheme. I'm sorry, what?
But we certainly have evidence of that here in the record of the workings of how these agencies work together and what had happened more or less behind the scenes. And it seems like your argument here is really goes to whether or not the loosely affiliated set of agencies meets the definition of enterprise under the statute.
That is my argument, yes. And what we don't have here, we do have some evidence that the people involved here were committing the same crime over and over and over again. That's for sure. Not my client, but some other people. That's for sure. But what we don't have is any evidence of a hierarchy to the criminal enterprise. In other words, we don't have any evidence that Ms. Richardson or anyone else gave orders and that people were working for her to commit the crime. We don't have any evidence. Yes, Judge.
How about this evidence? How about the fact that I'm assuming you would agree that it's not just coincidence that each of these entities, these multiple entities, which comprised by a number of individuals, would shuffle the personnel upon investigation. So once it became clear to individuals that part of this overall scheme was the focal point of government interest, suddenly the individuals who were in that scheme or part of that component would shift over and they would become agents or actors in another part. Doesn't that imply an organizational structure necessarily?
No. I don't think it does. I think it implies that people are trying to get away with committing crimes, which is clearly true.
But an entity and or the whole operation, if the operation itself has moving parts, doesn't that imply that someone or some group has arranged to make decisions to make those parts move in a way that avoids investigation?
I don't know that it does, Your Honor, and I also don't think the district court really found that. I think if you look at the finding of a loosely affiliated set of agencies acting with a common purpose, that's the finding we have here as to what the so-called structure is.
Not entirely. The district court also found, correct me if I'm wrong, I thought I read in the findings that the district court determined that individuals in these different entities as part of the overall organization would shuffle around.
Oh, sure.
As soon as one would be part of the focal point of an investigation. I thought that was part of the findings.
Absolutely. I didn't mean to suggest otherwise. Yes, as a factual matter, that is correct. And the district court did find that. But what
that
the district court...
decision making?
No, I don't think it does. And I don't think what it doesn't imply is somebody said, someone's in charge and says, okay, here's what we're going to do. Now we're going to do X, Y, and Z. And I don't think the district court found that. And that's
where I'm pushing back on you when you say someone was in charge. I thought that the language of some sort of arrangement for decision making or some sort of structure, that either one of those would be sufficient for the second prong of an enterprise. Not necessarily that one person is making the decisions or that there's a hierarchy, but somehow there's a decision that's being made as an organization to shuffle people from one place to the other. Why isn't that enough?
Because I think in order to separate racketeering from conspiracy or any other crime where people get together and agree to commit crimes, there does have to be some structure, has to mean something. So there has to be some sort of hierarchy or the language is you must have people telling people what to do.
You keep saying structure, but the element is either an arrangement or structure.
Yeah, an arrangement can't be anything because otherwise every aiding and abetting case is also a racket and every conspiracy case is also a racket.
Well, not just any arrangement for decision making.
But I don't know that we have an arrangement for decision making here. I don't think a loosely organized set of agencies working towards a common purpose means an arrangement for decision making. It sounds to me like it means a bunch of people getting together and they want to do the same thing, which is falsely bill Medicaid, which in the last minute and 10 seconds, I just want to give two sentences on the theft counts. Ms. Richardson's not guilty of aiding and abetting theft because the only action here that caused DHS to surrender any money that they wouldn't have surrendered is that caused DHS to surrender any money is the submission of bills, in particular false bills. And there is no evidence, and the state has not argued, that Ms. Richardson knew that her co-defendants were going to submit false bills, or that she intended her presence or actions to assist in the submission of false bills. The district court did not find that. The state did not argue that was proven. On appeal to this court, the state has not argued that that is true. And I think that silence is telling. The submission of the enrollment forms, even if you conclude that Ms. Richardson was involved in that, those forms did not cause DHS to surrender one dime to anyone. It was only the bills. The false bills are a swindle, no question about that. But Ms. Richardson did not aid and abet that swindle. Therefore, she's not guilty of the underlying offenses, and she's not guilty of racketeering. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Butler. And counsel for respondent, you may proceed. And if you would, please identify yourself for our record.
Good morning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Krista Berry, Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the respondent in this matter, the state of Minnesota. Appellant was found guilty at trial of the one count of racketeering and eight counts of aiding and abetting by swindle. I'd like to start with racketeering, as that appears to be the focus as well here. And the court was right to hone in on the second part of that second element required for an enterprise. And here the trial court, while it's true that one sentence does appear in the order once, the trial court actually specifically found a four-level structure to the enterprise in this case, and discuss that twice at different places in the findings of fact and conclusions of law at page 2 and page 6, and that's document 152, describing the four levels, what each level was responsible for and who comprised each level, and specifically found the appellant at the top of that structure, directing and coordinating the entire scheme. In addition to describing that four-level structure, the court made multiple findings regarding appellant's involvement in that enterprise, including specifically finding that appellant was involved in billing. She was involved in many ways intentionally in the affairs of the enterprise, and that's on page 12 of the court's order, where in addition to the many other ways, such as hiring and training, that the court found that appellant was involved, she was also involved in billing. As one of the justices inquired, one of the important parts of the trial court's finding as well was this movement from agency to agency. In this case, the first agency involved, the charging period is approximately 4 years, and there were five agencies. The first agency was Abundant, and appellant submitted the false enrollment forms to enroll that agency with DHS, and then the false claims began being billed. When the agency inevitably came under investigation for fraud and DHS stopped those payments, the agency, essentially all the resources of that agency, including personnel, money, billing information, simply moved from the next to the next agency down the line, which was bridging. And again, appellant would enroll using the false enrollment forms bridging and then begin everything all over again. In this way, the agencies, and as the trial court found and as the record shows, supported one another structurally by moving all of these resources and tools necessary for the next agency to replicate the billing fraud that had occurred at both the Best of Care and the agency previous to it. The trial court also made multiple findings about appellant's role within this enterprise, starting with, as I referenced before, billing and being in constant and how to run and manage these agencies. Again, the trial court specifically found this four-level structure that appellant was at the top of it, directing and coordinating everything. So we see from her consistent communication with her co-defendants that appellant was involved in nearly every aspect of running these agencies, starting with the billing that she was personally involved with, as found by the trial court and as shown in the record as a whole. You can see that appellant accessed minutes hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of times. and had the login information for each. Yes, I'm sorry.
What does the evidence tell us was the arrangement for decision making?
If you look at the record as a whole, what stands out is the appellant really was making all of the decisions for all of the agencies. She was directing co-defendants when she didn't personally bill herself. She was directing co-defendants in submitting billing. In fact, appellant recognizes that there is evidence in the record in this regard herself. On page 30 of her brief, she notes in the footnote that there's evidence in the record showing that appellant directed co-defendant Schwab specifically to submit false claims based on false timesheets in excess of $35,000. And that relates to count two of aiding and abetting theft by swindle. And the record shows multiple communications between appellant and the co-defendants directing how to bill, when to bill, and specifically teaching them how to commit the fraudulent billing that she herself had committed at Festive Care, which was her agency previous to this case.
Is there enough in the record for us to define some specific decision-making arrangement or structure of the organization? And if so, what is it?
Absolutely. Looking at the record as well, and do you want cites to the record as well, or just to speak generally about the facts?
Well, however you'd like to answer, I just want to get a sense of whether the state believes there's enough to actually identify. Mr. Butler talked about hierarchies. I mean, there are some cases where you can look and you can identify individuals. You can actually plot them on a chart and say, this is what the hierarchy looks like. This is the arrangement. This is the structure. I want to get a sense of whether you believe the record supports that sort of a defined or definable structure in this enterprise.
Absolutely, it does. And the trial court described the four levels. You had recipients at the bottom, had PCAs at the second level. The third level was co-defendants who maybe managed discrete sections of separate agencies. And then specifically, the trial court found appellant at the top directives and teaching co-defendants how to replicate the billing, the fraudulent billing schemes that she had done at Best of Care. We have, when you look at appellant's multiple email addresses that she had set up, communicate with people and with DHS about agency affairs, constant communication with the defendants. One co-defendant said that she spoke to appellant multiple times a day regarding how to manage the agency that she was working on. And as the trial court found those four levels, each of those levels had their own responsibilities. For example, on the first level with the recipient, they would not be involved in the agency. And the trial court also specifically found appellant at the top. And looking at the record of the communications and the decision-making and the teaching of the fraudulent billing schemes, the trial court found that appellant was at the top of that four-level structure.
Ms. Berry, counsel for appellants, a number of times mentioned that there must be a distinction with the this racketeering statute and conspiracy violations and to some extent perhaps even aiding and abetting type of offenses. And I'm curious, do you have a thought with regard to that? Is there a clear line of delineation, or is it possible in cases like this it's simply a prosecutor's decision? In other words, yes, you have racketeering, which also could be separately charged as a conspiracy or simply left as aiding and abetting.
I think racketeering is distinct. I also think it's important to keep in mind, we've touched on the legislative history a little bit in Pallant's oral argument, and the legislative history here, the very first section of the racketeering statute, instructs that the racketeering statute should be liberally construed to address the impact of economic crimes and the political power that these crimes exert. So I think right away, from the very first section of the racketeering statute, we have a legislative intent tell us that it should be broadly construed, that as counsel indicated, that the mafia is not what the statutory drafters had in mind. They had a broader goal in mind. Also, if you look at the case law, it does require more than just aiding and abetting conspiracy, but those requirements are met here. It's not just the Wynn case, which of course is the first case that we need to consider, but also United States versus Cragness talks about how these elements are not so rigid as to be one kind of enterprise presenting itself at all times. And even Wynn has the quote that everyone quoted in their briefs about it's more than just a kingpin. So it was meant to be more than the mafia, but the elements ensure that it is not simply a repeating of a conspiracy. It does require more, but that is met here as the trial court found and as the record shows.
So, counsel, what I just want to follow up on that question. What more is required to find racketeering versus a conspiracy? Because it does seem, while the two are distinct, it does seem that there is some overlap. What does the state have to prove to convict of racketeering versus conspiracy?
Oh, sorry. There is overlap, but I think the second element of enterprise does bring something more. For instance, in a conspiracy, you would not have to show the decision-making structure, whereas for an enterprise, you do. And I think it's important to look at the trial court's findings in their entirety and not just one sentence, because at two different places in the order, the court is very specific in finding this four-level structure and what that structure was and what those levels were, and finding that appellant was at the top. And that is something that the state would not need to prove for conspiracy. That answer your question, Justice Yana?
It does. Thank you.
Okay. Are there any other questions?
I don't see any.
So I think. Okay. So if there aren't any further questions on hierarchy, I would just, in sum, just point out, when you look at the record as a whole and the order as a whole, the trial court made many, many findings regarding appellant's role with the organization, not just in billing, but in hiring and training and drafting documents, basically doing all of the aspects that you would expect to keep an agency up and running so that the fraudulent billing could continue. She was involved personally in most of those aspects and was also involved indirectly by directing her co-defendants. And that's part of the trial court's findings as well. And all of that shows that the evidence is sufficient to find appellant guilty and to find that there was an enterprise here. But I think it is important to look at that trial court's order in its entirety and not just one sentence of it.
Would you turn to the elements of theft by swindle and the sufficiency of the evidence in that regard?
Yes, and I think before starting on the theft by swindle or the aiding and abetting theft by swindle counts, I think important to point out that appellant was not charged with theft by swindle. She was only charged with and only found guilty of aiding and abetting theft by swindle. And when you examine appellant's arguments from the perspective of aiding and abetting, which as your honors are, appellant could be found guilty of aiding and abetting without committing the overt act that constitutes theft by swindle herself. So appellant's first argument regarding the enrollment forms really doesn't apply factually here, although it would apply if she were charged with theft by swindle, whether or not the enrollment form in and of itself is a swindle. It just doesn't apply here because she was charged with aiding and abetting only and not theft by swindle directly. Moreover, as laid out in respondent's brief, and I would refer to the written submissions in this brief, the state's position is that the enrollment forms do constitute a swindle. They contain false representations that tricked DHS into enrolling the agency, which of course is necessary. No agency can submit claims without being first enrolled, and the enrollment form does affirm that everything is true and accurate. In addition, the argument ignores the rest of the record, which shows, as we've discussed previously, that appellant was involved in billing as well, both personally and by directing billing. As appellant's brief even acknowledges for count two, appellant was directing co-defendant Schwab. And I realize appellant would say that that's not sufficient, but appellant herself acknowledges that there is evidence in the record showing that appellant was directing billing. And so even if that argument is considered, it simply is not factually applicable here because we have so much more than the enrollment forms, and she is also not charged with theft by swindle. Appellant's second argument is regarding intent, and again is premised on an incorrect articulation of value. Value must be proven, but is not proven with the intent. And again, it got a little muddy with separating the theft by swindle from aiding and abetting. But I think once you step back and look at it from the perspective of aiding and abetting theft by swindle, those arguments become clearer. Are there any questions about specifically about the aiding and abetting counts?
Looks like there are none.
So seeing no further questions, the state would respectfully ask that the court affirm the verdicts in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Berry. And Mr. Butler, you may provide rebuttal if you wish.
Thank you. I wanted to start with one factual clarification. Counsel said a couple times that Ms. Richardson had taught people how to commit billing fraud. I think that's the word she used. But there's no evidence of that other than Ms. Schwab's statement, which goes to count two, about submitting false bills. There's no evidence that there's no other statements, there's no other accusations from anyone that Ms. Richardson taught anyone how to do anything. Ms. Schwab's statement, as discussed in our brief, is not sufficient to support a conviction on count two anyway. And even if it was, that is one count of theft by swindle, which obviously does not support a racketeering conviction and doesn't support the other theft counts. Each theft count is its own count. Each theft count has to be considered separately. You need multiple theft counts to support racketeering. It is true that Ms. Richardson was convicted of aiding and abetting theft by swindle, as counsel said, but that's precisely the problem, because for the state, because aiding and abetting requires proof and findings beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Richardson knew her co-defendants were going to commit a crime and that she specifically intended her presence or actions to assist in the commission of that crime. The state had to prove those two things for each of the separate six-month charging periods for each of the eight theft counts. They had to prove them over and over and over and over again because these counts are separate. It's not, unlike the racketeering, it's not one big thing. And the state did not argue to the trial court that it had proved any such thing. The trial court did not find that the state had proved any such thing. The state does not argue in its brief to this court, they didn't hear today an oral argument, an argument that it had proved any such thing. And that's because it didn't. There were clearly swindles going on here by people, maybe people that Ms. Richardson knew or was involved with in some way. But aiding and abetting is a very specific theory of liability. It is a specific. Two things. Theft by swindle is a specific intent crime. Aiding and abetting is a specific intent theory of liability. And what those two mean is that the state had to prove that in each of the eight time periods, Ms. Richardson wanted to help her co-defendants steal $35,000 or more. And the state has not argued that it proved any such thing. And without that proof, you don't have eight convictions of theft by swindle. And if you don't have eight convictions, or at least two convictions of theft by swindle, you don't have racketeering. And as a result, the evidence was insufficient to support the convictions in this case, and this court should reverse the convictions. If there are no further questions, I'll rest on the brief. Thank you very much.
Very well. Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your comments today and the briefing, and we will be taking the matter under advisement in the usual course. You each have a good day.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you both.
Thank you, Ms. Berry.
You too.